Penguin Random House Audio presents Confounding Oaths by Alexis Hall. Read for you by Neka Okoye.
Author's note. Please note that Confounding Oaths includes a number of themes some readers may prefer not to engage with. These include, but are not limited to, sexual content, racism, colorism, discussion of the transatlantic slave trade, violence, the threat of violence and danger, murder, a missing, presumed abducted minor, blood sacrifice, including graphic description of an animal sacrifice in Chapter 21, social non-acceptance of LGBTQ+ relationships. Prologue. Introductions, gentle listener, remain in order. Although I'm really not sure why, I assumed I would only have to write one of these damnable things, after which I fully anticipated that my Lord Oberon, having accepted that whatever misunderstandings may recently have passed between us, are surely as nothing compared to a timeless Ouroboran eternity of loyal and mirthful service, would welcome me back to his court with open arms. Spoiler, he didn't. Frankly, I expected to be jesting in the Invisible Palace at the end of the Middling Road sometime last February, and do not know what is taking him so long. Instead, I remain here, trapped in the dreary, damp, culinarily moribund country you recently, well, recently-ish, what's a millennium or so between friends, started calling England and forced to make my living by recounting for the mass market some of those stories I originally compiled for my master's delight alone. This is the second of those stories I have chosen to share. If you have not read the first, why not? Do you personally dislike me? Are you determined to see me suffer interminably and without even the comforts of a scribbler's income to lighten my exile? I swear, just when I thought my contempt for your species could not sink any deeper. If you have, like the discerning mortal creature I am sure you are, read my previously published work, then you will know that the story in question took place in the year 1814, beginning shortly after the exile of Napoleon to Elba. This new narrative takes place just after his escape, a little under a year later, in the March of 1815. In the few months between my visits, the British burned Washington as part of the confusingly named War of 1812. Eight Londoners died in a flood of beer, and a great white serpent arose in the north of England and devoured several villages. What will follow is a tale of beauty, blood sacrifice, and the wonderfully cruel business of granting wishes. You are, I hope, here primarily for the cruelty. That's my specialty, after all. And if you are not, you have chosen a very peculiar era to read about. Chapter 1. I first encountered Mr. Cesar during the unfortunate business with his cousin that had begun with her losing her clothes at a ball and ended with her sacrificing a British peer to an ancient goddess, fucking a disgraced noblewoman, and developing a lifelong aversion to march pain. Not necessarily in that order. In the near year that had followed, I had been observing that lady's friends and family closely in case they should prove likewise diverting, but thus far they had not. Mr. Cesar, in particular, had proven deeply tedious. His studies for the bar had languished somewhat, and were about to begin languishing, rather more for reasons you will soon discover, and he was spending the majority of his time at various London institutions that catered to a certain sort of gentleman with a certain sort of interest. This latter point, you may think, would grab my attention, but I am not mortal, and I am not so prurient in my outlook that mere sodomy arrests me. Indeed, I would probably have given up on Mr. Cesar as a prospect entirely had he not, at a ball hosted by the Vicomte de Lou, punched a fellow guest in the jaw. The blow in question would not land until later in the evening, but I mention it now in case you, like me, find balls in general rather dull, unless something unexpected is happening and might therefore put the book down in disgust, were it not for the reassurance that in a few short pages you will be able to watch an irritating man get smacked in the teeth by a slightly less irritating man whose teeth-smacking skills, if we are honest between ourselves, leave a great deal to be desired. I begin my tale in earnest, then, clinging in the shape of a woodlouse to the ceiling of a carriage whose occupants, in descending order of age, were Mr. Cesar, his friend Miss Bickle, and his two sisters, Miss Cesar and Miss Anne. We are starting early, partly to build tension ahead of the much-anticipated teeth-punching, and partly because I am given to understand that you mortals find it more enjoyable to watch other people's misfortunes if you learn a little about them first. And on the subject of learning a little about people, there is some context surrounding the Sazars, which will, over the course of the narrative, prove pertinent. Their mother, Lady Mary, had been born the youngest daughter of the Earl of Elmsley, but had defied the conventions of the ton by marrying a freedman of Senegalese birth, whom she had met through her work with the abolition. And whereas in the enlightened 21st century the marriage of a British aristocrat to a person of colour is a wholly unremarkable thing that results in no hostility whatsoever, in the bad old days of the 1800s it caused quite a scandal. Isn't it wonderful to know how far your species has come? At any rate, those are the inhabitants of the carriage, and this, as best I recall it, was their conversation. "I was wondering," Miss Bickle, a fair-haired, doe-eyed creature who stubbornly remained an ingenue despite being some way into her 19th year, was asking the group at large, "if after the ball is over, or if the ball becomes wearisome, any of you would be interested in reading my kshun?" "What's a kshun?" asked Miss Sazar, who, at 16 years of age, was now formally out in society and thus learning the fine art of pretending to care about things other people cared about. Of all her siblings, she was the one who most favoured her father, her eyes and her complexion, both a deep brown that almost glowed in the waning sunlight. Mr. Sazar, immaculately presented and patrician as ever, gave his sister a warning look. "Please don't encourage her, Mary." "Kshun," Miss Bickle explained, ignoring her friend's admonition, "is an abbreviation of avrection." Unable to quite help himself, Mr. Sazar disregarded his own advice and offered the obvious question. "And what is avrection?" "Ah!" Miss Bickle's face lit up. "Well, you see, that is itself an abbreviation of avid reader fiction. I am an avid reader of the works of the anonymous lady author of Sense and Sensibility, and I, along with some lady friends, have formed what we call an avid readerdom devoted to the wider anonymous lady authorverse." Miss Anne gave a thrilled gasp and tossed her fashionable ringlets. Though she was by far the youngest in the carriage, her grasp of the mortal art of flattery was greater than any of her companions.
"How fascinating."
"I'm not sure I understand," admitted Miss Sazar. "What do you actually do in this...
"Avid readerdom," Miss Bickle reminded her. "We meet and we discuss the works of the anonymous lady author..."
Mr. Sazar, growing increasingly aware that he was the only gentleman in the carriage and beginning to wonder if this was hampering his ability to follow the conversation, continued to look sceptical. "These works you insist upon calling the anonymous lady authorverse?"
"Yes."
Miss Bickle had a fine line in confident nods, and she deployed one of them now. "You don't think that's a rather silly name?" Never having considered anything silly in her entire life, and being, I suspect, one of the few mortals who appreciated the etymology of the word, Miss Bickle was unperturbed by the criticism.
"Not at all. I think it rather splendid."
The Misses Sazar, to their brother's chagrin, both agreed that it was splendid indeed. "Although," added Miss Sazar, "I'm not entirely certain how this group of yours differs from a literary salon."
"Ah, well," Miss Bickle explained, "we do not only read and discuss the works, we also write our own stories set within the wider anonymous lady authorverse."
Miss Anne clapped her dainty hands.
"Oh, how marvellous!"
"Is it, in fact, marvellous?" asked Mr. Sazar. "Is it not, in fact, a slightly peculiar thing to do?" Before Miss Bickle could either deny or embrace the peculiarity of her chosen hobby, Miss Sazar was leaning forward with fatally sincere interest and asking,
"But what are these stories about?"
"For example," Miss Bickle began with the joy of an enthusiast encouraged to expound upon their area of enthusiasm,
"my current Wittipobwa..."
The look of perplexity on the faces of her audience was enough to make her clarify. "That is, work that is in the process of being written, is called The Air and the Wastrel, and it concerns events that I imagine occurring between Mr. Wickham and Mr. Darcy in their youth."
"What sort of events?"
prompted Miss Anne with an innocence that caused her brother to chime in immediately with, "Do remember that Anne is 14. Miss Bickle, who had indeed overlooked the lady's age, opened her mouth, closed it again, and then said somewhat demurely,
"Japes."
"And would I be able to join your avid readerdom?" asked Miss Sazar. "I have read all of the anonymous lady author's works and might like to try my hand at writing avrections."
"Oh, that would be lovely," Miss Bickle beamed. "At the moment, it's just me and Miss Penworthy." I really don't...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?